with Comrade Walters. Tonight he's going to be speaking on Man the Toolmaker.
Right, thanks very much.
Man the Tool Shaker.
Same thing. Now, the story of mankind is divided, as we've already come to know, into a prehistoric and a historic period. The historic period, the latter, is distinguished by the use of writing. The prehistoric period, which is the longer by some 50 times at least, can be investigated only in the light of surviving scraps of human material equipment. And the further back we pursue the story, the scantier these scraps become. The oldest traces of human activity are therefore stone tools. And I might add that even 50 times at least is an understatement, because it's been established that mankind, or a type of man, existed in the Pliocene, which is about 5 million years ago, and was a tool maker. So that'll give you some idea of the length of time and the importance, as a matter of fact, of the Paleolithic period. Now, in our previous talks, we have considered the general background of prehistory, the age of the Earth and its coming into existence, the succession of life in geological time by natural selection and adaptation, the emergence of mankind and mankind's further development as a social hunter and food gatherer. The Paleolithic period and the transition from hunter to farmer. This evening, I intend to concentrate on one of the most important aspects of development of mankind, the toolmaker. Now, mankind is a social animal, we all know that, or at least we ought to know it by now, distinguished from all other animals by having evolved a unique combination of biological attributes, which enables the species to develop a culture by having the ability to make tools and communicate ideas. Other mammals, including members of the primate order to which mankind belongs, have evolved specialized bodily equipment suited to some particular mode of life. In the process of evolution, man avoided any such specialization and retained the pliant five-fingered hands, which were so useful to his small tree-dwelling ancestors, and we've already dealt with that, the prosimians, and with the further improvement of the opposable thumb. When the immediate forerunners of man acquired the ability to walk upright habitually, their hands became free to make and manipulate tools, activities which, in the first place, dependent upon adequate powers of mental and bodily coordination, but which in turn, in all probability, increased those powers, so that it was a two-way process, which I think you ought to understand by now, because we have touched upon this previously. The evolution of new bodily equipment in response to a change in the environment took millions of years genetically, and that we've already established. But relying on what can be described as extra bodily equipment of his own making, which could be quickly discarded or changed as circumstances dictated, mankind became the most adaptable of all creatures. The ability to make fire, construct dwellings, and wear clothes, this followed from the use of tools. And these cultural activities have enabled man not only to meet changes of environment, but to extend his range into every climatic zone. In other words, as far as mankind was concerned, a creature had evolved that was no longer subject to natural selection. No longer was there a need for biological mutation and adaptation in order to survive and compete successfully with other species, or to a change in environment which resulted in biological specialization and often eventual extinction. And I would like you to take special note of this because we have here, as it were, an analytical dichotomy. I know that sounds a lot of jargon, but the fact is that on the one hand, we have a unique combination of biological attributes, which is the nature of the human species and can be called human nature, which is more or less unchanging. And on the other hand, you've got the behavior of human beings, which is constantly changing. Man is a member of the zoological classification known as the Hominoidea, which also contains anthropoid apes. The anatomical structure of man and ape is not so very different. But in mental capacity, there is a tremendous qualitative gap. Possession of a great capacity for conceptual thought, in contrast to the mainly perceptual thinking of apes, is now generally regarded by comparative psychologists as distinctive of mankind. And I don't think there can be any question about that whatsoever. The systematic making of tools of various types required, not only for immediate use, but for the future, implies a very marked capacity for conceptual thought. Now, at this point, I would like to mention something about the events which established the greater antiquity of man, because if we define man as the toolmaker or the tool-making animal, then the question as to the age of man resolves itself into the question of the geological age of the earliest known artifacts. And artifacts are deliberately shaped implements. And it was not until about 130 years ago that the possibility that mankind had existed for more than a few thousand years had hardly been considered. Now, according to Archbishop Usher's chronology, and I think Archbishop Usher went around about the 16th century, he was a primate of all Ireland or something, but it's not important, really. What's important is that according to his chronology, which was still current at the time, and that's 130 years ago, the first man had been created in 4004 BC on March the 23rd. And according... I don't know if Archbishop Usher was present when this creation took place, but I believe he further claimed that it took place at 10:30 in the morning. However, with the discovery of the remains of mammoth and other extinct animals in the ancient river deposits, known, of course, previously as Diluvian, in various places in Europe, the belief was engendered that there had been several periods of creation, and mankind, it was claimed, belonged to the last, and the diluvial animals or animals of the previous period had been wiped out by a universal deluge of much greater magnitude than the historic biblical Noah's Ark flood. Needless to say that the great French paleontologist Cuvier adhered to this view. And round about 1690, a London pharmacist named Conyers found a pointed piece of flint close to the bones of an elephant. And this was unearthed in gravels near Gray's Inn Lane, as it was then called. Years later, in the 18th century, antiquaries concocted the explanation that it was used by a Briton attacking one of the elephants which were with the Roman army under Claudius. In 1797, another antiquary, John Ferrer, recognised as implements some chipped flints which had been found in a brick pit about 12 feet down at Hoxney near Diss in Suffolk. And he was mentally sharp enough to realise the implication of these finds and published the view that they had been, to use his own language, used by a people who had not the use of metals. The Gray's Inn Lane and the Hoxney implements were in fact flint hand axes. characteristic tools of the early Stone Age, and they occurred in diluvial, or as we would say now, in Pleistocene deposits. And in the 18th century, however, the possibility that man had a prehistory did not occur to the great minds of the time. Nevertheless, in the 19th century, the idea that man did have a prehistory was forming in the minds of several observers. And flint implements associated with bones of diluvial animals were reported from Belgium caves in 1839 and from Kent's Cavern, Torquay, in 1838. The French amateur archaeologist Bouche de Perthes, is that right? Bouche de Perthes, announced that he had found flints worked by antediluvian man in ancient gravels of the Somme, near Arbeville, France, in 1846. But the majority of scientists at that period were very reluctant to accept his conclusions. However, in 1859, English geologist Prestwick and the archaeologist John Evans investigated the evidence in great detail and concluded that he had found unquestionable proof of mankind's great antiquity. In the meantime, geologists had been accumulating evidence that during the diluvial period, ice sheets spreading from highland areas had enveloped a large part of northwest Europe, including much of the British Isles. The extinct mammoth, Elephas primigenius, and woolly rhinoceros, Rhinoceros antiquitus, whose remains had been found in deposits of this age, were inhabitants of the sparsely wooded tundra which fringed the ice sheets. And in the 1860s, excavations in the caves of southwest France brought to light skeletal remains of Ice Age man at Cro-Magnon, Laises. Now, we've already touched upon this, Cro-Magnon man, and these skeletons were found, as well as tools and pieces of bone and ivory, on which he had carved pictures of the animals which he hunted, mammoth, rhinoceros, and reindeer, etc. And as researches proceeded, it became clear that the Pleistocene comprised an alternation of intensely cold or glacial and warmer or interglacial periods, and that the Cro-Magnon cavemen lived during the last glacial around 20,000 years ago. Whereas the earliest hand axes from the Somme gravels dated from a much earlier stage when conditions were were interglacial, and the animal and the fauna included hippopotamus and the straight-tusked Parkland elephant, Elephas antiquus. Within the present century, it has been established that mankind existed in Europe during a temperate interval early in the Pleistocene Ice Age, about 400,000 years ago, according to recent estimates. Human technical progress has gone step by step with the discovery of better materials of which to make cutting tools, and the history of man is therefore broadly divisible into the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, and the Steel Age. And these are stages of technical development rather than chronological periods. Thus, the Stone Age, which dawned with man himself 3 or 4 million years ago, ended in the Middle East with the discovery of metals about 400 to 300 BC. And I hope that answers your question some time ago when you were asking when did the Bronze Age begin. Well, the Bronze Age began in the Middle East at that period, but Stone Age culture persisted in Britain until after 2000 BC, and it commenced in Britain round about 1800 BC. In Australia, and other more remote parts, Stone Age culture lasted until the present day. And men, of course, soon learnt that some kinds of stone are better than others for chipping into tools. And wherever they were available, he chose siliceous rocks and minerals with perfect conchoidal fracture. Now, a conchoidal fracture is the kind of fracture that you get if you hit a piece of glass. It's shell-like in appearance, like a conch shell. And that is what is called a conchoidal fracture. And this stone, which was appropriate, was flint. It was either flint, it was chert, in some cases it was obsidian or chalcedony, or and fine-grained silcrates. And these forms of silica are very hard, yet they can be chipped or flaked quite easily. And this gives a fractured edge as sharp as a razor. Now, I don't know if you do know, but the flint industry is still in existence. The flint nappers, I believe, have gone out of existence because they used to make gun flints at one time, and up until quite recently. And whilst I was at Rickmansworth on one occasion, they have a mine, or better to describe as a quarry, in which they quarry the chalk and also the flint at the same time, because the chalk and the flint are found together. The flint is sent to the potteries, where it's reduced by pressure to powder and finally reduced to a liquefied form, where it's used as glaze for pottery. And of course, there are certain characteristics which I'll explain. Now, in Europe, mainly England and France, flint was the rock most commonly used by prehistoric man for making into implements. If I can give a more closer description, flint consists of minutely crystalline silica, and mineralogists describe it as microcrystalline quartz. In broken, unweathered pieces, it's glossy and appears black, grey or brown. Very thin pieces are translucent, and nodules fresh from the chalk or from the residual formation called clay with flints generally show a dull white outer crust or cortex. The difference between the white cortex and the glossy, relatively dark interior of a flint nodule is one of texture only. The cortex is porous and scatters light, while the interior is very dense in structure and absorbs light. Flint has ultra-microscopic pores, which are enlarged by the action of various natural solvents, so that when pieces of the typical dark flint are weathered, they develop a porous skin or patina. Initially, this appears bluish or white, depending on the depth to which weathering has proceeded. But it is apt to become stained and yellowish brown or red through absorbing iron compounds from percolating water. And flint, mainly obtained by prehistoric man from banks and beds of rivers, or from cliffs and sea beaches. But later on, I'll explain that in the Upper Paleolithic, flint was mined, and industrial kind of a factory production took place. Now, the Australian Aborigines discovered in modern times, and the Australian Aborigines were still in the Stone Age as far as technique was concerned. They discovered that bottle glass and porcelain telegraph insulators serve as excellent materials for making spearheads. And I saw some very, very good examples of this in the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford. If you're ever in Oxford and you've got any time to spare, well worth going into the Pitt Rivers Museum to see some of these examples, because they're really remarkable. In a few regions, early man used the shiny black volcanic glass called obsidian, which was often deemed to be superior to flint. Now, there were two main methods of making stone implements. There was the core tool industry and the flake tool industry. The simplest way of producing a stone which will cut, which of course is the primary type of artifact, is simply to break it in half and to use the resulting fresh, sharp edge. But to produce a stone tool which is even slightly more specialised, one of two courses must be followed. The lump of stone, whether pebble, nodule or angular fragment, can be brought to the desired shape by flaking or napping, and the flakes removed from the lump are then primarily waste products, while the core of the lump becomes the implement, and that is a core tool industry or core tool technique. Alternatively, flakes struck from the lump can be used as implements with or without further trimming. And this further trimming is known as dressing, a retouch, or secondary work. In this case, the core is the source of flake tools and will serve to yield flakes until too small, when it is discarded as waste. A discussion of Stone Age culture must be put in its proper time perspective. All the most ancient relics of man so far discovered belong to the Pleistocene period of geology and so fall into the last 2 million years of the Earth's history. And you will recall that this period was broken up into glaciations and interglacials. And we touched upon this when we dealt with the succession of life in geological time when we came to the Pleistocene period. These periods are closely related to changes in Stone Age technology. It would take far too long to go into any detail just now, so I'll give you the bare outline of the cultural sequence in relation to geology. The Stone Age comprises the whole period of human culture which preceded the knowledge of metalworking. At this stage of culture, stone was not the only material used in making tools, but it was the most important. From the earliest part of the Stone Age, the Lower and Middle Paleolithic, objects of more perishable materials have seldom survived, and the knowledge, or our knowledge of the culture, is based upon the study of stone tools alone. The classification of the forms of tools which characterize the various cultures is complicated by the fact that the technological advance of mankind has proceeded at vastly different rates in different parts of the world. For example, prehistoric Europeans knew only stone tools at a time when Egypt and Mesopotamia worked bronze. The natives of America and New Zealand were still in their Stone Age when white men conquered them. And until quite recent times, remote Saharan tribes made flint arrowheads. And some Australian and Oceanic natives still make and use stone tools, as do, I may add, a number of other peoples, which we won't mention at the moment, but there are other peoples that still do. Now, the word Paleolithic, as you no doubt know, meaning Old Stone Age, this embraces the cultures of the hunting and food-gathering peoples of the Pleistocene period, and the term Paleolithic is also applied to stone working techniques which were employed in these cultures and therefore in sometimes applied in a technological sense to culture of a much later date. For example, the culture of the modern hunter food gathering peoples of Australia and the Kalahari Desert, when it is unaffected by white man's civilization, may be described as Paleolithic. That is, it's a stone technique. the tools are made from stone. But of course not with any chronological implication, obviously. The terms Lower, Middle and Upper Paleolithic, meaning according to geological usage, are adopted in Europe and Asia. Lower Paleolithic is used to describe the cultures which begin the sequence in Western Europe. The hand axes, coarse flake tools and pebble tools, known as the Acheulean Clactonian. Upper Paleolithic is regularly applied to the blade cultures of Aurignacian, Magdalenian and Gravettian and Creswellian of the last glaciation about 128,000 years up to the beginning of the Holocene, which started about 10,000 years ago. And you know all about that because we've already dealt with that, or you should know about it. However, I would like you to note something in relation to this glaciation. Of course, a lot of this stuff is very, very complicated, and I don't want to complicate it too much, but I'd like you to note that this idea of glaciation is based upon the Alpine classification with its four glacials named Gunz, Mindel, Riss and Worm, which has been the criterion for nearly 75 years, and data are still fitted into the apparent security of their pigeonholes, as it were, giving an impression of repeated conformation, yet its simplicity is illusory, because the record supplied by deep sea deposits shows that there were 21 glaciations occurring in the last 2,100,000 years. And consequently, there will be many references to glaciations because the main glaciations were in turn broken up by relatively warm spells called interstadials and more severe cold, so that you had within a glaciation you had a number of interglacials, as it were, and glacials. So there is a lot of reference to local glaciation, which of course has got nothing to do with this terminology. It's obviously part of the glaciation, but it has a local name. The Middle Paleolithic in this area denotes Mosterian fine flake culture, and I'll explain what that is later on, which intervened between the two, that is, between the Clactonian and these other cultures. These terms can be used in a chronological as well as a technological sense, and this is rather unfortunate because it causes a lot of ambiguity. For example, in using the term Middle Paleolithic to describe the flake cultures of North Africa, which are contemporary with many blade cultures in Europe, this manner of subdividing the Paleolithic is best avoided, and it rather be a technological descriptive term, blade, faceted, butt flake, etc., that kind of a term, which deals directly with the technical matter of stone tool production. This should be substituted. The terminology adopted by archaeologists in South Africa and India substitutes for this early, middle and late Stone Ages, the late Stone Age being contemporary with the Neolithic, and the middle representing both the European Middle and Upper Paleolithic. I hope you understand all that, because I don't. However, we now come to the Mesolithic. I did point out when I was dealing with the Neolithic Revolution that there was a period which was called Mesolithic, which intervened between the Old Stone Age and the New Stone Age. Now, it's not such a simple proposition, because in the last century, a hiatus or a break in continuity was thought to have occurred between the last of the Paleolithic culture, ending with the final departure of the ice from Europe, and the culture which introduced the Neolithic. And it's subsequently been established that in fact several distinct cultures flourished in this interval, and that they have been called Mesolithic because they are meso in the sense, for example, that they are in the middle between the new and the old Stone Ages. The new Stone Age now called the Neolithic, and the old Stone Age the Paleolithic. The forms in which Neolithic culture subsequently appears in Central and Northern Europe frequently embody survivals from the cultures of the Mesolithic food gatherers, whose descendants adopted and influenced the new economy. And in current usage, the term Mesolithic is not quite straightforward. For again, it happens that in Europe, the chronological division corresponding to the Mesolithic coincides with a change in the technique of stoneworking, so that the term Mesolithic is liable to be used by some authors in a technological sense when there is no corresponding chronological sequence. In connection with the later pre-Neolithic cultures of North Africa, the term is particularly inappropriate, since the main problem there is precisely the relationship of these cultures, whether they are parents or cousins, to the upper Paleolithic and Mesolithic of Europe. Though the term Mesolithic means literally Middle Stone Age, it should not be confused with the Middle Stone Age of African archaeologists, which corresponds rather to the upper Paleolithic of Europe. Now, I hope that I've explained what that is all about, but however, it's not of great crucial importance. The word Neolithic, of course, meaning New Stone Age, and these cultures are characterized by polished stone tools and, of course, by the practice of agriculture and stock raising, food production, and of the basic crafts of early civilization, pottery and weaving, etc. And we went to some length into this when we dealt with the Neolithic Revolution, not with the implements so much and the works of art and the crafts, but more to the essentially economic aspect of the Neolithic in relation to food production. And that, of course, is really the most important aspect of the Neolithic. Of course, it's a bit unfortunate that it's been called the Neolithic, because the most important part of the development was in food gathering, it was in food production, and not with polished stone artifacts. The term Neolithic was adopted originally to denote the new technique of polishing stone before its connection with these more fundamental activities was realized. The date at which farming appears in various parts of the world varies greatly, as the increasing precision of the chronology of this stage shows, and its duration compared with the earlier divisions of the Stone Age is quite short. For example, in Britain, it only lasted about 1,500 years or so. In a limited geographical area where a basis for dating exists, one may speak of a Neolithic period with definite chronological limits in mind. But Neolithic is best applied in its economic sense. However, in archaeological literature, the term is sometimes used of cultures late in date than the invention of agriculture, in which only a selection of Neolithic activities, possibly excluding farming, is practiced. And thus, a culture widespread in the Sahara is termed Neolithic merely on the evidence of its stone tools, although it's very difficult to be sure that agriculture or stock raising were included in it to any great extent. The Neolithic culture of Europe, or cultures of Europe, are all contemporary with bronze-using civilizations of Egypt and Mesopotamia, and some of their stone implements show the influence of metal types, so that the Neolithic stone-using culture was in existence, whilst in the Middle East they were already using metal. Now, the inconsistencies in the use of terms, which I've attempted to explain, come from the tendency, which is still prevalent, to look for a similar succession of technological stages in all parts of the world and to assume that in the old world, at least these stages were traversed more or less simultaneously. As often happens in other branches of biological study, this is not the case. The facts of prehistory do not fit exactly into abstract categories. Individual cultures are usually named after the place, the region where their characteristic relics are found or were collected, and at this stage I'd like to touch upon them. But before I do so, I'd like you to have a look at these plates. I'm afraid that the photocopying is very poor. It was done at head office. But you'll be able to have a look at those whilst I'm, and if you hand them round, whilst I'm giving you some information about these various local cultures. Now, the earliest tools were called eoliths, and the Eolithic Age, or Dawn of Stone Age, is a completely hypothetical period. It's an assumption. It doesn't exist. But eoliths, or dawn stones, were stones which were used because of their natural qualities. And I think that we can safely assume that mankind first used unfashioned stones, picked up at random, or chosen for their convenient natural shapes, and mankind was therefore a tool user before he became a tool maker. And later, when he began to shape stones purposefully, his early clumsy efforts would scarcely be distinguishable from natural shapes or naturally broken stones. In fact, the first known tools, which came from the Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania, East Africa, are simple pebble tools made by knocking off one or two flakes from one side of a water-worn pebble. Now, I think you know about Olduvai Gorge. It's been investigated and excavated by the two Leakeys, Mary and Louis Leakey. Louis is now dead, and his son Richard Leakey. And this is a very, very famous archaeological site. The development from pebble tool cultures to hand axe cultures has been demonstrated at the site of Olduvai Gorge, because the gorge is a late Pleistocene feature which has cut through a series of early Pleistocene lake deposits. And consequently, the various layers were more or less exposed, and they were in a chronological sequence, and their age has been ascertained by various methods, which I illustrated earlier on. The argon, potassium, and the carbon dating processes, so that there's a marvellous example of how, in the sedimentary rocks, the various cultures can be established, establishing, of course, their age. A local time scale has been established on the basis of four periods of lake sedimentation, but this can't be correlated with the European sequence. The lowest deposits in bed 1 contains the pebble culture known as Olduan, and this is in layers of volcanic tuff and ash, and this in this bed, and it's been dated by potassium argon to more than 1 million years ago, so that man was making tools 1 million years ago. In the earlier stages of the Olduan culture, tools consist largely of pebbles which have been split with one or two blows directed from one side, resulting in a rough cutting edge. And then you had bifacially worked pebbles tools in which one edge, or the cutting edge was produced by removing flakes alternately from each side of the cutting edge. And these predominate in the latter stages. In these stages, more or less pointed tools were made with a pebble butt, and by rough trimming of the butt, these tools develop into crude hand axes. In beds 1, 2 and 4, the hand axe culture at Olduvia shows a development closely analogous to that observed in Western Europe. A similar sequence of pebble tool and hand axe culture is also known from the coastline of North Africa in Morocco. The culture known as Clactonian culture, examples of that are in these plates, as are most of the others, was the most primitive time type of flint industry found in Europe. It's one consisting of flakes and pebble tools and apparently related to the Olduan of Africa or to the chopping tool industries of India and the Far East, which you've got to understand that although these cultures have got local names, which have been derived largely from early European anthropology and archaeology, as cultures, they are to be found in all parts of the world, but they are given, of course, the local name. So far, there's only sporadic industries of this type, and the most well-known is the Clactonian industry of East Anglia, and another one of the lower Thames Valley, which is dated to the early part of the Hoxnian interglacial and possibly to the preceding Elster glaciation about 200,000 years BC. There was also another example at Vertis Zolos in the Vertis Mountains of Hungary, associated with an early type of Homo sapiens. Now, another culture was the chopper culture. The Southeast Africa, outside of the area covered by Acheulean culture, the European type sites of this culture are at Arborville and at St. Anchel, a suburb of Amiens in North France. And the Abervillian, previously known as the Chilean, is often treated as a distinct culture, but from all points of view, the technique, tool forms and chronological continuity, it is best regarded as the earliest phase of the Acheulean culture, which was largely a production of hand axes from flakes. And this was from about 690,000 years BC to about 128,000 years. So man, of course, by now you will know he's been making tools for a hell of a long time, and he made the same tools for thousands and thousands of years without anything happening at all to alter it. And these Acheulean hand axes had astonishing uniformity wherever they're found. It's an axe, it's an all-purpose hand axe, and it's useful for chopping and scraping and all manner of performances that were current at that time. Now the next technique is the Levalloisian technique, and this was personified by a great advance in the manufacture of flake tools. This scene in the Levalloisian, this was a technique so named after an archaeological suburb of Paris. Again, of course, a European phenomenon. This is first recognized in Europe much later than the Clactonian, being found in France in deposits attributed to the local equivalent of the sale glaciation. And I warned you about these local references to glaciations about 90,000 years ago. And thereafter, it recurs in different stages of evolution in the last interglacial, that is the one preceding the last glaciation, and we're now, of course, in the Holocene, which is considered to be a different era of time anyway, the last interglacial, and during the earliest part of the last glaciation. So it went from the interglacial into the last glaciation, and different stages of the development of the technique are distinguishable accordingly as large and broad flakes or long narrow blade flakes are produced. And it was for a long time thought that the Levallois technique was a separate flake culture like the Clactonian, but it's now recognized that this technique was an integral part of the late Acheulean and later Mosterian flint industries. Now, another important technique is the Mosterian culture. And the Mosterian culture of Europe flourished in the latter part of the last interglacial and through the first phase of the last glaciation known as the Wieschel locally. Technologically, the culture has roots in the two main traditions of the Lower Paleolithic, and flakes are struck continuously from a discoid core. In other words, it's in the shape of a disc, which ultimately becomes too small for further flaking and is chucked away. The butts of large tool flakes are usually faceted, that is, they're worked upon, but generally more coarsely than in the Levallosian. I don't know whether you'll be able to recognise that from those drawings, but there are examples there when you get round to them. Now, the Mosterian in Europe has been found as a result of excavations and statistical studies carried out again in Europe, principally in France. And it's divided into a number of different industrial styles or cultures. The principal are the standard Mosterian, the Quina Mosterian, the Terese Mosterian, and the Denticulate Mosterian, and the Mosterian of Acheulean tradition. Now, those terms don't mean a lot unless, of course, you take an academic interest in studying all these different artifacts. But the most important part of this period, as far as we are concerned tonight, is the Quina Mosterian, which can, with fair certainty, be attributed to a distinct human type. Its characteristic implements having been found in undisturbed cave deposits, along with bones of the primitive Neanderthal man, Homo neanderthalensis. And we've already mentioned him. The succeeding cultures are associated in Western Europe with mankind of the modern type, Homo sapiens, as are certain other forms of Mosterian culture. And after their arrival, no further trace of Neanderthal man is found, so that it can be assumed that Neanderthal man became extinct, but the culture which he was initially responsible for, that was the Quina Mosterian, particular kind of very, very skillful stone tool production, carried on. So that you can see that a culture can carry on in spite of the fact that the people who invented it or produced it and practiced it had long since become extinct. Now, the technique which followed the Mosterian in Western Europe, these are found in a succession of cultures grouped under the term Upper Paleolithic, which bring the story from the second Wieschel interstadial, and I mentioned what that was. That is a warm spell in the actual glaciation. The warmest spell between the second and third subdivisions of the last glaciation, that is, to be precise, down to the final retreat of the ice from Europe at the end of the Pleistocene about 10,000 years ago. And these cultures are all recognized by the use of the blade technique. In their flint industry, a technique first adopted as an industrial style in North Africa, and also the Syrian-Palestine coastline in the Eemian interglacial, and presumed to have spread by diffusion or culture contact into West Europe. So you can see that man, apparently, all the evidence points to the fact that man originated in Africa, and that he spread to Europe and carried his various cultures with him. And of course these became localized, and this is why they've got European names. And the Eemian interglacial was about 90,000 years BC. Now, all the upper Paleolithic cultures are alike in their concentration on blade production, in which they contrast with the Mousterian predecessors. The blades are long, narrow flakes with approximately parallel sides, and these are struck directly from the core, which frequently assumes the shape of a fluted, truncated cone. Now, no individual preparation was required for the blades, but the striking platform on the core had to be periodically renewed, and the flake removed in doing this is another hallmark of the technique. And the removal of long, thin blades probably required the use of a punch of wood or bone or antler horn, the point of which could be accurately placed on the relatively small area of the striking platform. And some details of the process may be surmised from eyewitness accounts of the manufacture of long flint or obsidian blades by American Indians in historical times. And one example of this, which an account was given, which was published in 1885, and the description was that the punch was a stick between 2 and 3 inches in diameter and from 2.5 feet to 4 feet long, having at one end a pointed tip of bone or antler horn. For some kinds of work, the tips were scraped to a rather blunt point, and for others, left with a slightly rounded end, about 1/2 inch in diameter. If the work was done seated, the core was embedded in hard earth and held by the feet, and the shorter flaking staff was used. Sometimes the core was firmly bound between strips of wood on which the napper stood while operating with the longer staff, and the latter was held in both hands, the upper end against the chest. The point was placed in a prepared indentation on the squared edge of the core, and the blade removed by sudden pressure. The work was divided among the people in the tribe, because they were a tribe, they were in tribal culture, which is far different from what we're talking about just now, but they still had the Stone Age technique. And there was some specializing in preparing the quadrangular cores and chipping the indentation for the point of the staff, so that it was a sort of collective process. There was a division of labor even at that particular time. And the principal flint tools of Upper Paleolithic, the knife with a blunted back, end scrapers, and the burin or graver, were all formed on thin blades. The Upper Paleolithic in Western Europe, with the arrival of the use of the blade technique, Upper Paleolithic stone industries, which were often largely composed of tools for making other tools or weapons, of bone or wood, became progressively subject to local differentiation. And it's not possible to mention all of the many different local cultures and industries of Africa, Asia and Europe just now. What we are dealing with is the local succession in Britain and France. Other Stone Age cultures of the Upper Paleolithic were the Perigordian of central France, the development of which was interrupted by the arrival from without of the Aurignacian culture, and the Upper Perigordian or Gravettian which is found overlying the Aurignacian in cave sites, is related to the early Perigordian or Chattel-Pyrrhonian. Now, you see, all these cultures are found very often together, and sometimes it's a job to distinguish which are which. But, of course, those people who've spent a lifetime in investigating all this, they know all the angles, and they know the differences, and they will know what to look for. Now, supervening on the Gravettian was the Solutrean culture, and the outstanding characteristic of this culture were the manufacture of points resembling a laurel or willow leaf. And there is a masterpiece of this kind in the British Museum, which measures 11 inches by 2.5 inches and is less than 1/4 inch thick. And that must have been remarkable feats of skill to get a stone flint fragment to those kind of dimensions. The Solutrean horse hunters, as they were, made no distinguished use of bone and antler, but they practiced an advanced art of stone sculpture in high relief depicting processions of animals. The succeeding culture, called the Magdalenian, reflects the well